Chapter 5. Kathmandu, Nepal. As advertised, Russell and Marjorie pulled into the Hyatt's turnaround precisely at 9 a.m. the next morning. Bright-eyed and smiling, the twins greeted Sam and Remy with another round of handshakes, then ushered them toward the Mercedes. The sky was a brilliant blue, the air crisp. "Where to?" Russell asked as he put the car in gear and pulled away. "How about the locations where Frank Alton seemed to be spending most of his time?" Remy asked. "No problem," replied Marjorie. "According to the emails he was sending Daddy, he spent part of his time in the Chobar Gorge area, about 5 miles southeast of here. It's where the Bagmati River empties out of the valley." They drove in silence for a few minutes. Sam said, "If it was your grandfather that was photographed in Lo Mon Tong..." "You don't think it was?" Russell said, glancing in the rearview mirror. "Daddy thinks it was." "Just playing devil's advocate. If it was your grandfather, do you have any idea why he would have been in that area?"
"Can't think of a thing," replied Marjorie flippantly.
"Your father didn't seem familiar with Lewis's work. Are either of you?" Russell answered. "Just archaeology stuff, I suppose. We never knew him, of course. Just heard stories from Daddy." "Don't take this the wrong way, but did it occur to you to learn what Lewis was up to? It might have helped in the search for him."
"Daddy keeps us pretty busy," Marjorie said. "Besides, that's why he hires experts like you two and Mr. Alton."
Sam and Remy exchanged glances. Like their father, the King twins seemed only marginally interested in the particulars of their grandfather's life. Their detachment felt almost pathological.
"Where did you two go to school?" Remy asked, changing the subject.
"We didn't," Russell answered. "Daddy had us homeschooled by tutors."
"What happened to your accents?"
Marjorie didn't answer immediately.
"Oh, I see what you mean.
When we were about 4, he sent us to live with our aunt in Connecticut. We lived there until we finished school, then moved back to Houston to work for Daddy." "So he wasn't around much when you were growing up?" Sam asked.
"He's a busy man."
Marjorie's reply was without a trace of rancor, as though it were perfectly normal to bundle your children off to another state for 14 years and have them raised by tutors and relatives.
"You two ask a lot of questions," Russell said.
"We're curious by nature," Sam replied. "Comes with the job." Sam and Remy expected little to come of their visit to Chobar Gorge, and they weren't disappointed. Russell and Marjorie pointed out a few landmarks and offered more canned travelogue. Back in the car, Sam and Remy asked to be taken to the next location, the city's historical epicenter, known as Durbar Square, which was home to some 50 temples. Predictably, this visit was as unrevealing as the first. Shadowed by the King twins, Sam and Remy walked around the square and its environs for an hour, making a show of taking pictures, checking their map, and jotting notes. Finally, shortly before noon, they asked to be taken back to the Hyatt.
"You're done?" Russell asked.
"Are you sure?"
"We're sure," said Sam.
Marjorie said, "We're happy to take you anywhere you'd like to go."
"We need to do some research before we continue," Remy said.
"We can help with that, too." Sam put a little steel in his voice. "The hotel, please." Russell shrugged.
"Suit yourself."
From inside the lobby, they watched the Mercedes pull away. Sam pulled his iPhone from his pocket and checked the screen. "Message from Soma." He listened to it, then said, "She's dug something up on the King family." Back in their room, Sam put the phone on speaker and hit speed dial. After 30 seconds of crackling, the line clicked open. Selma answered with, "Finally. We were on a tour with the King twins."
"Productive?"
"Only in that it reinforced our urge to get away from them," said Sam. "What have you got for us?"
"First, I've found someone who can translate the Devanagari parchment you found at Lewis's house."
"Fantastic," Remy said.
"It gets better. I think it's the original translator, the A. Kalarami from Princeton. Her first name is Adala. She's almost 70 and is a professor at... Care to guess?
No, Sam said.
Kathmandu University.
Selma? You're a miracle worker, Remy said.
Normally I would agree, Mrs. Fargo, but this was dumb luck. I'm emailing you Professor Kalarami's contact info.
Okay, next.
After hitting dry hole after dry hole in researching the King family, I ended up calling Rube Haywood. He's sending me information as he gets it, but what we've got so far is interesting. First of all, King isn't the family's true surname. It's the anglicized version of the original German, König. And Lewis's first name was originally Levis.
Why the change? Asked Remy.
We're not entirely sure at this point, but what we do know is Lewis immigrated to America in 1946 and got a teaching job at Syracuse University. A couple years later, when Charles was 4 years old, Lewis left him and his mother and started his globetrotting.
What's next?
I found out what business Russell and Marjorie are handling there. One of King's mining concerns, SRG, or Strategic Resources Group, acquired permits from the Nepalese government last year to conduct, and I quote, exploratory studies related to the exploitation of industrial and precious metals.
Which means what, exactly? Remy asked. That's an awfully vague mission statement.
Intentionally vague, Sam said. Selma replied, the company isn't publicly traded, so information is hard to come by. I found two sites that are being leased by SRG. They're to the northeast of the city.
A tangled web, Remy said.
We've got the King twins overseeing a family mining operation in the same place, and at the same time, Frank disappears while looking for King's father, who may or may not have been ghosting around the Himalayas for the past 40 years. Am I forgetting anything?
That about covers it, Sam said.
Selma asked, do you want the particulars on the SRG sites?
Hold on to it for now, Sam replied. On the surface, it seems unrelated, but with King Charlie, you never know.
After asking the Hyatt's concierge to arrange a rental car, they took to the road, with Sam driving and Remy navigating, a Kathmandu city map flattened against the dashboard of the Nissan X-Trail SUV. One of the few lessons they'd learned, and had since forgotten, from their last visit to Kathmandu some 6 years earlier, came rushing back to them soon after leaving the hotel. Except for major thoroughfares like the Tridevi and the Ring Road, Kathmandu's streets rarely bore names, either on maps or signs. Verbal directions were given relative to landmarks, usually intersections or squares, known as chokes or tolls, respectively, and occasionally to temples or markets. Anyone unfamiliar with such reference points had little choice but to rely on a regional map and a compass. In Sam and Remy's case, they were lucky. Kathmandu University lay 14 miles from their hotel in the foothills on the extreme eastern outskirts of the city. After spending 20 frustrating minutes finding the Arnico Highway, they made smooth progress and arrived at the campus only an hour after setting out. Following signs in both Nepali and English, they turned left at the entrance, then drove up a tree-lined drive to a brick-and-glass building fronted by an oval plot brimming with wildflowers. They found a parking spot, walked through the glass entrance doors, and found an information desk. The young Indian woman sitting at the counter spoke Oxford-tinged English.
Good morning. Welcome to Kathmandu University. How may I help you?
We're looking for Professor Adala Kalrami, said Remy.
Yes, of course. One moment.
The woman tapped on a keyboard below the counter and studied the monitor for a moment.
Professor Kalarami is currently meeting with a graduate student in the library. The meeting is scheduled to end at 3.
The woman produced a campus map, then circled their current location and that of the library.
Thank you, Sam said.
Kathmandu's campus was small, with only a dozen or so main buildings centered atop a rise. Below were miles and miles of green terraced fields and thick forests. In the distance they could see Tribhuvan International Airport.
To the north of this, just visible, were the pagoda-style roofs of the Hyatt Regency. They walked 100 yards east down a hedge-lined sidewalk, turned left, and found themselves at the library's entrance. Once inside, a staff member directed them to a second-floor conference room. They arrived as a lone student was leaving. Inside, seated at a round conference table, was a plump elderly Indian woman in a bright red and green sari. Remy said, "Excuse me, would you be Professor Adala Kalrami?" The woman looked up and scrutinized them through a pair of dark-rimmed glasses. "Yes, I am she." Her English was thickly accented, with a lightly musical quality common to many Indian English speakers. Remy introduced herself and Sam, then asked if they could sit down. Kalrami nodded to the pair of chairs opposite her. Sam said, "Does the name Louis King mean anything to you?"
"Bully?"
she replied without hesitation.
"Yes."
She smiled broadly. She had a wide gap between her front teeth.
"Oh, yes, I remember Bully. We were friends."
The glimmer in her eyes told the Fargos the relationship had gone beyond mere friendship.
"I was affiliated with Princeton, but had come to Tribhuvan University on loan. That was long before Kathmandu University was founded. Bully and I met at a social function of some kind. Why do you ask this?"
"We're looking for Louis King."
"Ah, ghost hunters, are you?"
"I take that to mean you believe he's dead," Remy said.
"Oh, I do not know. Of course, I've heard the stories about his periodic manifestations, but I have never seen him or any genuine pictures of him. At least, not in the last 40 years or so. I'd like to think if he were alive, he would have come to see me."
Sam pulled a manila folder from his valise, pulled out a copy of the Devanagari parchment, and slid it across the table to Kalrami. "Do you recognize this?" She studied it for a moment.
"I do. That is my signature. I translated this for Bully in—"
Kalrami pursed her lips, thinking,
1972.
"What can you tell us about it?" Sam asked. "Did Louis tell you where he found it?"
"He did not."
Remy said, "To me, it looks like Devanagari."
"Very good, my dear. Close, but incorrect. It is written in Loa. While not quite a dead language, it is fairly rare. At last estimate, there are only 4,000 native Loa speakers alive today. They are mostly found in the north of the country, up near the Chinese border, in what used to be—"
"Mustang," Sam guessed.
"Yes, that's right. And you pronounced it correctly. Good for you. Most Loa speakers live in and around Lo Montong. Did you know that about Mustang, or was it a good guess?"
"A guess. The only current lead we have on Louis King's whereabouts is a photograph in which he supposedly appears. It was taken a year ago in Lo Montong. We found that parchment at Louis's home."
"Do you have this picture with you?"
"No," Remy said, then glanced at Sam. Their shared expression said, "Why didn't we ask for a copy of the picture?" Rookie mistake. "I'm sure we can get it, though."
"If it is not too much trouble. I like to think I would recognize Bully if it were truly him."
"Has anyone else come to see you recently about King?" Kalrami hesitated again, tapping an index finger on her lip.
"A year ago, perhaps a bit longer than that, a pair of kids were here. Strange-looking pair."
"Twins? Blonde hair, blue eyes, Asian features?"
"Yes. I did not particularly like them. I know that is not a charitable thing to say, but I must be honest. There was just something about them."
Kalrami shrugged. "Do you remember what they asked you?"
"Just general questions about Bully. If I had any old letters from him or remember him talking about his work in the region, I could not help them."
"They didn't have a copy of this parchment?"
"No."
Sam asked, "We never found the original translation. Would you mind?"
"I can give you the essence of it, but a written translation will take a while. I could do that tonight if you'd like.
Thank you, said Remy. We'd be most grateful. Professor Kalrami adjusted her glasses and centered the parchment before her. Slowly she began tracing her finger down the lines of text, her lips moving soundlessly. After 5 minutes, she looked up. She cleared her throat.
It is a royal edict of sorts. The Loa phrase does not translate well to English, but it is an official order. Of that I'm certain.
Is there a date?
No, but if you look here at the upper left corner, there's a piece of text missing. Was it on the original parchment?
No, I photographed it exactly as it appeared. Do you remember if the date was on the original you saw?
No, I'm afraid not.
Would you care to venture a guess?
Do not hold me to this, but I would estimate between 600 and 700 years old.
Go on, please, Sam prompted.
Again, you must wait for the written version.
We understand.
It is an order to a group of soldiers, special soldiers called sentinels. They are instructed to carry out a plan of some kind. Something detailed in another document, I suspect. The plan is designed to remove something called the Thurang from its place of hiding and transport it to safety.
Why?
Something to do with an invasion.
Does it explain what the Thurang is?
I do not think so. I am sorry. Most of this is only vaguely familiar to me. This was 4 decades ago. I remember the word because it is unusual, but I do not think I followed up on it. I am a classics teacher. However, I have no doubt there is someone on staff here who would be of more help with the word. I can check for you.
We'd appreciate that, Sam replied. Do you remember Lewis's reaction when you gave him the translation?
Kalrami smiled. He was elated, as I recall. But then again, Bully never lacked for enthusiasm. He lived life to its fullest, that man.
Did he say where he found the parchment?
If he did, I don't remember. Perhaps tonight, while I'm translating this, more will come back to me.
One last question, Remy said. What do you remember about the time Lewis disappeared?
Oh, yes, I remember. We spent the morning together. We had a brunch picnic along a river, the Bagmati on the southwestern side of the city.
In unison, Sam and Remy leaned forward. Sam asked, Chobar Gorge?
Professor Kalrami smiled and tilted her head at Sam.
Yes. How did you know?
Lucky guess. And after the picnic?
Lewis had his backpack with him. That was more common than not for him. He was always on the move. It was a beautiful day, warm, not a cloud in the sky. As I recall, I took pictures. I had a new camera, one of those first instant Polaroid models, the ones that folded up. Back then, it was a marvel of technology.
Please tell us you still have those pictures.
I may. It will depend on my son's technical skills, if you'll excuse me.
Professor Kalrami got up, walked to the side table, picked up a phone, and dialed. She spoke in Nepali for a couple minutes, then looked over to Sam and Remy and covered the phone's mouthpiece.
Do you have mobiles with email access?
Sam gave her his address. Kalrami spoke on the phone for another 30 seconds, then returned to the table. She sighed.
My son. He tells me I need to come into the digital age. Last month he started scanning. Is that the right word? All my old photo albums. He finished the ones from the picnic last week. He's sending them to you.
Thank you, Sam said. And to your son.
Remy said, You were saying about the picnic.
We ate, enjoyed each other's company, talked. Then, in the early afternoon, I think, we parted company. I got in my car, and drove away. The last I saw of him, he was crossing the Chobar Gorge Bridge.